This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where the top experts and 28 Minutes come together to understand the big issues of the day. And what bigger than this? We're about to hear the Prime Minister's plan for the safe route out of lockdown. What do the experts think should be in it? It's been a disastrous winter in terms of the pandemic. But now, 16.5 million of us have received at least one dose of COVID vaccine, and the measures taken over the last 2 months are bringing down infection rates and with them hospitalisations and deaths pretty quickly. If you're listening to us in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon has already indicated her strategy for the near future. And for those of you in England, all is due to be revealed on Monday. Boris Johnson has promised to lay out a plan for the lifting of restrictions and a return to something like life as we once knew it.
We want this lockdown to be the last, and we want progress to be cautious, but also irreversible.
But on what basis will he have drawn up his plan? What will the experts have been saying to him? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me today are three scientists who are going to advise me on the way forward based on their best knowledge of how the virus behaves. And how we behave. With me are Professor Azra Ghani, an infectious disease epidemiologist of Imperial College in London, the behavioural psychologist Professor Stephen Reicher from the University of St Andrews, and Dr Mike Tilsley, associate professor at the University of Warwick, an epidemiologist and lead author of a recent report on schools and the pandemic. Let's begin with the science of the progress of the pandemic and what you would want to see in terms of infection and protection levels before we start reopening. Azra Ghani.
We are where we are now with still, unfortunately, quite high levels of infection in the UK, but making great progress in terms of the vaccine rollout. So first and foremost, we need to get those infection levels down. We need to certainly reduce the number of people that are in hospital and overwhelming the NHS at the moment. And then as we move forward, what we're aiming to do as epidemiologists is try to keep the reproduction number, that R number, below one so that we don't start to see an epidemic taking off. And what that means in practical terms is that as more of the population is vaccinated and become immune to the infection, then we can gradually start to lift the restrictions that we have in place. So this would be a gradual process where we might lift one set of restrictions, wait a few weeks, monitor that progress, and then continue to lift.
Mike Tilsley.
The staggering process is what's really needed. We do need to remember that any reopening is going to increase the R number. But of course, as we vaccinate, eventually we hope that that will have a positive effect upon mitigating for that. So we can't afford to go too fast. And the progress that which we exceed the progress we're making with vaccination. So patience, sadly, is the key so that we do avoid a resurgence as we gradually reopen society.
But I do wonder at what point we would think that the NHS was relatively safe from being overwhelmed, Azra Ghani.
Well, clearly the numbers are still remain very high, so getting those down initially is going to be a preoccupation. But we also need to think about what we want our long-term strategy to be. And there's no simple answer to it. I think a lot of the debate is either about elimination versus some manageable level. The chances are we want to be somewhere as close to elimination as possible, but at the same time, recognising that we can't keep really severe restrictions in place, that people have to live their lives and that these impact on other aspects, both of lives and livelihoods.
Mike Tilsley, it seems straightforward. You know, the vaccine rollout and results from Israel do suggest high levels of protection, either from infection and passing on infection and moderate or severe disease. So at what point could we say with vaccination that what remains of the infection is manageable?
I think it depends upon our definition of manageable. But before I get into that, I mean, there's a couple of things about the vaccine that we need to remember. You know, these vaccines are not 100% effective in an individual. So just because you have a vaccine, there is no guarantee that you have immunity. And of course, a lot of the efficacies that were published in last year were against development of severe disease. And what we knew less about was the ability of these vaccines to block infection and to block transmission. We now have a little bit more data on that suggests, at least if we take, say, the South African variant and others out of it, that they are reasonably good at blocking infection. But of course, in the long term, we're likely to see immunity waning, both from natural infection and from vaccination. So this is why it's not a one-way process. But in terms of the actual question as to what point can we say infection remains manageable, it actually comes back to the objective. And it really depends upon what our objective is in the long term. A lot of my modelling colleagues refer to me as the objective function guy, that, you know, I'm the one that's often talking a lot about, well, actually, if we're thinking about long-term control, it really depends upon what the government is trying to achieve. And as we touched on this, are we really trying to achieve elimination? Are we trying to achieve some kind of low-lying endemicity that we can keep under control? And of course, we need to factor in economics, we need to factor in people's well-being and mental health. And it becomes extremely complicated if we're trying to capture all of these into some kind of long-term objective. But unless we can properly define the long-term objective, it's really hard to determine at what level we consider the infection is manageable enough that we can reopen society.
Well, what do you think the long-term objective should be?
Well, I think this is why I'm an epidemiologist and I'm not a politician. I think the problem is that, you know, I do accept, you know, if you talk to an epidemiologist and you're only interested in direct impact of COVID in terms of COVID health, then you recommend a very severe strategy. But of course, in reality, what you're doing is you're trading off the long-term harms from COVID, i.e. you shut down because you want to prevent risk from COVID, from the long-term harms from lockdown, i.e. loss to the economy, loss to people's businesses, damage to mental health and well-being. And unfortunately, it's a very, very complicated calculation to trade off all of these to determine what the best policy should be. But it's really important that it's properly defined going forward so that we can determine how to come out of not just this lockdown, but how we might manage COVID in the future beyond this current lockdown.
OK, so given all that you've said, Stephen, how do you see the necessary overall strategy?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that for me, lockdown is the failure of a proportionate and early strategy to control the virus. It's because we've ignored the routine measures that we should have put in place and we didn't, and we ignored them even after there were warnings and even as the infections began to rise. That's why we had to suddenly slam on the brakes and put people in severe lockdown. And it seems to me that what we want to get to, at least in the medium term, is a position where we can keep on top of the virus and keep on top of outbreaks without having to have the blunt instrument of lockdown, where we can do it through more targeted interventions, through more efficient use of contact tracing, through isolating people and so on. So the point at which we can reopen is when the downward curve of infections meets hopefully the upward curve of improving the routine measures, the routine test and trace system, the making our environment safe. And the other point I would want to make is that one of the other problems we've had throughout this pandemic has been that there has been an attempt to find the single magic solution, the single magic bullet. At one point, it was Operation Moonshot and it was all testing. Then it becomes vaccines and nothing but vaccines. Now, vaccines are an integral part. Achieving population immunity is really important, but we're not going to be there for a long time. And so we need the other measures to suppress infection as well. We need an integrated and holistic strategy. And on the whole, we haven't had that. What we've had is delay, then emergency measures, relaxing those emergency measures, and the infection spikes again. And that's the cycle, that stop-go cycle we've got to get out of by having an integrated strategy to keep the infection at low enough levels that we can deal with it with targeted measures, not the blunt instrument of lockdown.
Well, that's a very good point at which to ask what an integrated strategy might look like in different sectors. And I think the one we should start with is with education. Boris Johnson appears most likely to announce the reopening of schools in England first. Now, there seems to be broad agreement amongst everybody that that's the right place to start. But Mike Tilsley, you've made a big study of this. You're the lead author of a report about this. What do we now know and not know about the risks of opening up schools?
What we have seen from the data is there does appear to be a higher risk of children reporting infection in secondary schools. And it does appear that actually cases do very much track cases in the community. So where we see that local prevalence is high, you tend to get more cases in schools. I mean, this is extremely common sense. So certainly I would very much suggest that when schools start to reopen, we might consider doing that in a more staggered way, either with, say, just key stage one or primary schools first, but monitoring that for, you know, a 3-week period, for example. And then if we can keep risk down, we then consider expanding that. We need to do it in a very staggered way so that actually when we send our children back to school, they stay in school.
Are there any other obvious mitigations short of staggering classes? In other words, that we could do instead of those, which would allow us perhaps to avoid the pitfalls of that particular approach?
I mean, I think there obviously there's been a lot of discussion around ventilation, and that's really, really important. There's another point, actually, that isn't directly schools, but also ought to be alluded to. One of the issues that's been discussed quite widely among scientific community is when schools open, it leads to other mixing within the community. So, of course, we know at the moment a lot of parents are at home homeschooling their children and are not able to go into work and not able to socialise with other individuals. At the point that schools open, we need to make the really, really strong case that, yes, children can be back in school, but this is not an excuse for other forms of mixing. We need to really make sure that parents aren't mixing at the school gate. You know, more parents aren't going out to work and doing other things because their children are now in school. And that could have a positive effect at reducing the rise in our number, so that really when schools open, the only thing that is happening is our children are back in class and we're not having these other levels of mixing in society.
So let's widen this out from schools and talk more generally about social mixing, because we're all very keen to see our friends and families again. What have we learned from the previous easing of lockdown that can help inform this easing of lockdown, Ashragani, about social mixing and transmission?
Certainly outdoors, I think, is something everybody would agree is less risky, and therefore initial relaxation really ought to focus on social mixing outdoors.
Now, what, for example, might be the risk of two households of older people, each of whom has had a double dose of the vaccine, meeting indoors? Would we say that the risk of that would calculate as so negligible, we should stop worrying about it?
It's very difficult to say at the current time. And the reason it's very difficult to say is that we still need to see how effective the vaccines are in this older age group. We obviously have clinical trial data, which is encouraging, but not all of that has been tested in the very oldest age group. And we are, of course, hopefully going to be getting more information in the coming weeks and months on that. And then I think it has to be an individual's risk perspective. Once the restrictions are relaxed, then if two groups of people are both fully vaccinated, and I think it will be important to have had the second dose as well, then there becomes a balance of risk. And that's quite a difficult one, but it will also, of course, critically depend on how much transmission there is ongoing in the community. And as long as we put in place systems that keep that transmission at a low level, then that further reduces the risk of two groups of people meeting.
Stephen Reicher, this one really is for you. To what level at this point do we need to continue to codify what people should do in terms of social mixing, as opposed to inviting them to assess their own circumstances?
Well, I think we've profoundly misunderstood the issue of adherence and non-adherence and the reasons why we've seen spikes in infections. Because a lot of the time when we talk about social mixing, the inference is that what's happening is people breaking the rules. And I think that's wrong in a number of rather important ways. I mean, first of all, actually, most people are complying. The levels of compliance are extremely high in things that people can do easily. If you look at mask wearing, they are higher now than they have ever been. So the public adherence is not a problem. except in particular areas. And the most obvious of those areas is self-isolation. People don't self-isolate. And that's not a matter of motivation. It's a matter of practicality. It's almost impossible to self-isolate within the home if you live in a multi-generational household. So the issue there is support. It's supporting people to do the right thing. And I think if we moved our understanding of adherence away from this image of the house party, of people egregiously breaking the rules, to an understanding that most people are trying valiantly to abide by the rules, but it's not always easy, I think we would get on top of this problem of adherence far, far better.
Let's say that we've reopened schools to some extent and it's gone pretty well. There have been no major new outbreaks. And then the government turns to the reopening of the economy. Do we know whether the seasonal transmission is a microbiological question, Azra Ghani? In other words, just how the virus behaves, or a behavioural one? It's about how we behave.
My own view is it's much more likely to be a behavioural one if it indeed has a big impact. When we have newly emerging viruses that are highly transmissible and a large proportion of the population are susceptible to them, any sort of marginal effects of seasonality tend to be overwhelmed by the ability of the virus to transmit. And so a very clear example is if we think back to 2009 and we had the swine flu circulating in the UK, that actually peaked in May, June, July time. And then actually had a smaller second wave in the winter. And yet we think of flu as a seasonal virus. And similarly, we are seeing at the moment a very severe wave in the Southern Hemisphere, South Africa, indeed Brazil, of course, is another country that have experienced very large waves of infection in their peak summer period. So I suspect the seasonality will develop over many, many years as we this moves to an endemic disease. But at the current time, this probably isn't the biggest issue. Of course, outdoors is less risky. So with more time people spend outdoors in terms of their contacts, that the less risky that will be.
Mike Tilsley, let's look at some of the risk factors. Is it possible to say anything from what we've learned, sensible about one's relative chances of being infected in a supermarket as opposed to a pub?
Yeah, I mean, this is really difficult. I mean, we have been able to sort of look at the data from, say, certain key workers, and we can look at that and say, well, actually, there are certain key workers. Obviously, you know, we can take health workers out of this because we know they are much more exposed to the virus. But for instance, key workers who work on transportation seem to be at much higher risk. It's really difficult to tease out without having sort of 100% accurate test and tracing data where you can trace every contact of an infected and actually sort of do this back tracing where we can work out where they were exposed to the virus. It's extremely difficult. But the key thing is obviously any environment where you are going to interact with more people is going to increase risk. We also know that there's a lot of infection, of course, within households, you know, so, and that's something that we can't do very much about other than, you know, isolating individuals who are infected within their own household. So it's very hard to untangle all of these. If we're looking at kind of relaxation policies and allowing people to mix, because we know that any environment where people mix more, particularly indoors, is likely to increase transmission potential, I always worry a little bit about putting a single number on it. So actually saying we're going to relax to allow 6 individuals or 10 individuals or 15 individuals to be together. From an epidemiological perspective, actually, it's much more important who those individuals are. So you're probably less risk of actually causing a big wave of infection if you allow 2 households with 5 people in each one of them to merge together compared with 6 different individuals from different households, because that then creates chains of transmission potentially across multiple different households. So it's one of those things that is a little bit nuanced, but actually is quite important when we come to thinking about relaxing controls, how we are going to allow individuals to interact with one another.
Can I say something about pubs? A study came out saying something that will surprise nobody, which is that when you look at pubs in the afternoon, people on the whole tend to keep their distance and tend to behave in relatively safe ways. As you go through the evening and they drink more, and they forget those things, then all of that breaks down, that they revert to the ordinary distances we keep. And when we're sitting with others that we know well, we tend to interact at some slightly less than a meter, that people begin to hug each other. They begin to forget again about all those mitigations. So, of course, I mean, it's not exactly a surprise to say you add alcohol to the mix when people are intimate, they forget the rules, and it makes spaces which might be safe under ideal conditions very unsafe in practice.
Let's move on to the question of travel, because this has been getting a lot of discussion recently and a lot of people are pretty desperate to travel. The tourism industry in the country obviously needs visitors. As we enter this next period, what are the risks involved in us travelling abroad and foreign visitors coming here, Azra Ghani? And does it have a lot to do with the question of these new variants?
Unfortunately, yes, it probably does have a lot to do with the variants, because clearly last year we created travel corridors and that would be linking areas with very similar levels of infection. But now that these new variants have emerged, we really do need to make sure we try to minimise their introduction. But if our aim again is to try to get to a very low level of infection across the population, we absolutely need to minimise local transmission, but also to reduce the probability of the importation of these new variants because of the implications they could have for vaccinations. So I think it's going to be quite challenging because it will depend on what other countries are doing. There's a lot of discussion at the moment about perhaps relaxing the testing for those that are vaccinated. But I think when we think of that particular issue, we do need to bear in mind that the vaccines are not 100% perfect. They may well have a very high efficacy against disease, but that does not mean somebody may not be carrying infection coming into the country. So I would caution a little bit about that. It may be much better to keep some testing in as a sort of double braces approach to travel.
Can I make a couple of points about the international question? Because I think they're really important. One is, I think we need to make a very simple choice between domestic opening and international opening. And I think the cost of being able to reopen domestically may be to control our borders internationally. It's a choice that people have been making in countries like Australia and New Zealand. And the second point, and I really think this makes this a key issue on the agenda, is, of course, in the longer term, the implications depend upon the rollout of vaccines internationally. And it makes vaccine globalization, it makes issues like, for instance, waiving intellectual property rights so other countries can produce the vaccine absolutely central to our enlightened self-interest. And so I think any question about the longer term strategy can never be adequate without putting the issue of the international rollout of vaccines right center stage.
Now, last year, we had a relatively few weapons in our anti-pandemic armoury. We had lockdown, we had distancing, not much else really. Now we added masks, and now we have vaccination and enhanced testing. And that could allow selective activity, which is why you've had a lot of discussion about vaccine passports on the one hand and pre-entry tests on the other. So let's look at those. Now, in scientific terms, Mike Tilsley, do we know how useful such a thing would be?
I'll say something briefly on, but actually I'm interested in bouncing this to Stephen, because I suspect actually one of the major things about vaccine passports is it could change people's behaviour in terms of being willing to take up the vaccine. You know, I'm not advocating this, but, you know, we are concerned about uptake, particularly in disadvantaged communities, in ethnic minorities, and also maps in younger people. We fear that the uptake might not be very high, which could mean that actually in the longer term, it could be really, really hard for us to get the levels of prevalence of the virus down low enough so that we can reopen a lot of society. You know, if, for instance, you can't go into a pub unless you show your vaccine passport, let's say in another 12 months' time, or, you know, you can't do any of these things domestically, whether that will improve uptake. And I'm not saying, I mean, there are ethical reasons why this might be a policy you never want to do. But I say I'd be really interested in getting Stephen's view on whether that might incentivize in such a way that we could improve uptake dramatically.
Stephen, I'll put that point to you at the same time as asking you about on-the-spot testing, which might be another way of allowing people back into big events. What does your work tell you about how people are likely to react to being asked to show that they've been vaccinated or being asked to take a test before they can do something?
Many people have been looking at this question, which is highly complex. It is true that it might be an incentivization to get vaccinated. On the other hand, if you haven't been vaccinated and you begin to get a point where particular groups are socially excluded from our society, they can't go to pubs, they can't go to football matches, and so on. And when you get to a situation where you're asked to produce your vaccine passport before you're allowed to go to particular places, in effect, stop and search. We know what that can lead to. It can lead to enhanced tension, enhanced conflict, and therefore precisely the opposite of what we're trying to get to. So I think there are real dangers. I suppose my feeling about vaccine passports is that whether they're good or bad is heavily contingent on the question of where and when. Until everybody has had the possibility of getting vaccinated, if we have vaccine passports, you're going to exclude those groups who haven't yet been vaccinated. And secondly, I think it's fine for certain things, perhaps like going abroad, but for regular participation in society, I think the forms of social exclusion are really dangerous. So I think we need to think very carefully about the implications for social exclusion, social division, and even social disorder if we begin to get to a point where particular groups begin to be excluded from society.
Okay, but and testing? That seems to be slightly different from the vaccine passport, probably slightly easier to sell.
Okay. Well, I have learnt this from the brilliant epidemiologists that I've been sitting with on various committees over various months, and so this is very much secondhand knowledge. But one of the things I have learnt is that when you think about testing, the issue isn't whether a test is good or bad, it's what it's being used for and what are the consequences. So the problem about some tests, like lateral flow tests, is they are very good as red light tests. If they test positive, you've got it and you should stop doing things. However, they're very bad as green light tests. In other words, if they test negative, it doesn't necessarily mean you haven't got it. And if you then just go out and you interact more, it can actually undermine the whole point of the testing. So for things like lateral flow tests to be used, they've got to be understood, number one, as tools for finding asymptomatic cases and taking them out of circulation, not for saying to people you're completely too safe to go out. That would be entirely counterproductive. And secondly, if you're taking people out of circulation, you've got to make it possible for people to self-isolate. So again, testing policies and tracing policies are pointless unless you've got support for self-isolation. Without that, the system doesn't make sense. So I'm not against mass testing, and I'm not against spot testing. It's how it's used, what it's being used for, and what support there is for people in terms of following up the consequences of being tested.
Okay, now to round up, Boris Johnson said he wants progress to be cautious and irreversible. I'm certainly hearing cautious from all of you. I suspect irreversible is going to be a hard ambition to meet. So very briefly, can we meet it? Azraghani.
I don't think we can ever promise to meet that, but we can aim to meet it. And the aim to doing that is to put all these other wider systems in place that mean we don't have to go back to these very crude measures of lockdown again.
Stephen Reicher.
One of the things that's concerned me throughout this pandemic has been the way in which things have proceeded on a wish and a prayer. To say, we want schools to be safe, for instance. We want this to be irreversible. Well, fond wishes are fine, but we need the hard policies to make that possible. So if it's to be irreversible, less fond wishes, more hard action.
Mike Tildesley.
I think it's a bold promise to say that any relaxation will be irreversible. But if we want to avoid going back into another large-scale lockdown, the key thing is react rapidly. If we start to see a resurgence in cases, we need to rapidly respond locally or more widespread if necessary to prevent that resurgence as quickly as possible so that we don't end up in another national lockdown, which I think all of us want to avoid.
My thanks to Mike Tildesley, Azraghani and Stephen Reicher, and we'll see which bits of that advice make it into the Prime Minister's strategy. Quite a lot of it, I suspect. We're back on Thursday evening next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirsty Knight. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's the one where we ask why Vladimir Putin is so afraid of Alexei Navalny. There's one about whether there might soon be a referendum on the reunification of Ireland. And there's one that asks why the Scottish National Party is so deeply divided at the moment.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, the host of the You're Dead to Me podcast, and I have some good news. Now that we're all stuck at home, again, we are bringing back homeschool history. And if you missed out the first time, you don't know what it is, it's our fun, family-friendly and informative show about, well, you can probably guess, yeah, history. And yes, we're bringing back the obligatory sound effects, of course. This time out, get ready to learn about the Great Fire of London, ancient Egyptian religion, the Scottish Wars of Independence, Mary Seacole, and one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that you'll have to tune in to find out which one. So that's Homeschool History with me, Greg Jenner, on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.